Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover. Thank you for supporting your independent bookstore and for silencing your cell phones. It is indeed an honor for me to introduce Stephen tonight as he presents his 17th novel, The Siege, featuring our own Sam Purdy in a setting far from Boulder. I met Stephen in 1991 when he gave the women in our little bookstore a copy of his first newly published first book, Privileged Information. Somehow I got to read it first. I'm still not sure how that happened. And my enthusiasm spread among my coworkers, and even one of whom never read a mystery in her life and became a devoted fan to Stephen. We invited him to do a signing with us, and he continued to do so through many books and many years. Long after he became a best-selling author, Stephen always remembered the people who were there for him in the beginning. So please join me in giving a very warm welcome to the author of The Siege, my friend Stephen White.
Thank you, Jess. Thank you all for coming. This is remarkable turnout. I also want to thank the wonderful people here at Tattered, and want to echo what Jinx just said. Supporting independent bookstores is an incredibly important thing at this stage of the publishing world, and I thank you all for doing it. I thought I'd start off tonight by reading a passage from The Siege. The passage I'm going to read is a description of a building, and the building was very much an inspiration for part of the story. And it plays a huge role in the book, and there's actually a photo of it in the front matter of the book, right between the title page and the half title. So this is the description with which the book opens. I'm always a little perplexed by the reading part of these events. I assume you're all here because you're pretty good at that part yourselves. It's customary, so I'm going to do it. The building on the edge of campus could be mistaken for a mausoleum erected beyond the boundary of the cemetery across the street. It's not. Some assume it is a mock courtroom for the nearby law school. It's not that either. Although the structure's Ionic columns suggest the imperial, like a treasury, or evoke the divine, like a temple, the word tomb is the tag attached by the community. The building puts out no mat and welcomes no stranger. The classic style was chosen not to invite attention, but rather to feel as familiar to passers-by as the profile of the elm tree that shades the marble steps leading up from the street. The scale is deceptive. The neighboring edifices are large and imposing, with Gothic flourishes or neoclassical grandeur. In comparison, the tomb feels more stout and diminutive than it actually is. The building's unadorned back is the only face that it reveals to the college. The sides are rectangular planes of marble, staggered in a brick pattern from ground to roof. There are no windows. In front, paired entry doors are recessed below a shallow gable at the top of 8 stairs. That portal, trimmed in stone, framed by columns, overlooks the ancient plots of a graveyard that counts among its ghosts the remains of Eli Whitney and Noah Webster. An iron fence, the posts smithed in the form of slithering serpents, separates the building from the public sidewalks on the adjacent streets. The architecture is symbolic. The few decorative elements are symbolic. The site is symbolic. What happens inside the building is, at least occasionally, symbolic. That fine spring day, though, the crowds gathering behind the hastily established police lines aren't gawking because of any symbolism. The curious are gathering because of the rumors of what is going down. Some students might be locked inside the mysterious building. The spectators don't know it yet, but the reality is they're there because the building is a damn fort. I've been in some version of the Tattered Cover 17 times, and as I ponder these events and you know, think in advance of what all of you would like to hear, I'm often perplexed, to be real honest. You know, the choices seem to be to talk about the book and spoil what you're about to read, or to, you know, somehow pretend that what goes on inside my head is, you know, truly that fascinating to all of you. I can never decide. I usually end up doing some of both, and I'll probably do that again tonight. But I'm going to start by asking a little something of you. How many of you follow my Twitter feed? I actually find that terrifically refreshing. And, it actually means that I can use my Twitter material in my talk tonight, which is a relief. The reason I have Twitter material is because my publicist thought that having a live Twitter feed would be a great way of sating people's curiosity about what goes on in my head, and she suggested I come up with a list of things that most people don't know about me, other than I'm ignorant about Twitter. And the way it works is I provide her the list, and she then pretends she's me. There is a lot of this going on in Twitter, so if you ever do wander there, be careful. Here's an example of one of my Twitter feeds. I flew a plane solo before I drove a car solo. My pilot's license number has 4 niners in it. After all these years, I still like saying niner. I'm not proud of that. Another one. I was once busted on Tom Sawyer's Island and taken to the Main Street jail at Disneyland. I was innocent, seriously. And one more, and then I'm going to move on. I was briefly a tour guide at Universal Studios. I was almost fired for telling David Nelson, Ricky's brother, where he could not park his car. I quit a couple of weeks later before they could actually fire me, truth be told, for being dull. One of my first discoveries in writing for Twitter is that I found that my mind really doesn't work in 140-character blocks. Since you're all so conversant in Twitter, I probably do need to tell you that a Twitter message can only be 140 characters long. And I'm a novelist. I tend to think in much bigger terms. What happened is that I would write things that were longer than 140 characters, and my publicist would chop them up before she sent them out on Twitter. It unfortunately made it seem like I couldn't have a complete thought and fit it into a sentence simultaneously, which is not exactly the reputation I was looking to get by going on Twitter in the first place. So here's an example of a short tweet. I used to be 6 feet tall. I am now 5'11". I don't know what happened to the inch, but I miss it. My favorite tweets are the ones that end up sounding vaguely like haiku, like that one. And the This is the last one before I move on to a discussion of the siege. It's possible that I may be the third or fourth best writer in my family. In some families, that would be a bad thing. In mine, it's okay. It's not about playing second fiddle. It's getting to be part of the band. The Siege. This is an unusual book for any of you who are familiar with the series. I'm going to tell a long story about how it came to be written. And if any of you heard me talk about any of the books before, they tend to come in two different ways. Some books feel like they're delivered to me from an inspiration point of view in a simple sentence that I might hear from someone or something I might learn, and I immediately know that there is a book to be found there. If you think about Kill Me or The Program, they both came almost full form to me from very simple communications with other people. The Siege was not like that at all. The first inkling about this book, if you want to really go all the way back, you go back to my childhood on Long Island. And although it's not an official tweet, something else you don't know about me is I'm fascinated by hurricanes. And I have been ever since I was a small child and watched these immense storms blow off the Atlantic and flood our neighborhood in Long Island when I was a child. And I have to think of basically an idea a year to write these books. And somewhere around 1999, 2000, Y2K time, I'm thinking of writing a hurricane story. And I did a tremendous amount of research, read numerous hurricane books, and actually made a two-night trip to the National Hurricane Center, where I hung out for 2 days as a Cat 5 storm was approaching Florida. So I was really ready to write a hurricane story. My publisher was not ready for me to write a hurricane story, and all that research went for naught. Move forward a couple of years, and it's September, October 2001, and like all of you, I was thinking about the same thing. It's right after 9/11, and I'm thinking about terrorism, and I'm reading a lot of stuff that all of you, I'm sure, were reading at that time. I'm paying attention to something that I've not found anybody else who ever paid attention to from that time, and that was a spending bill in Congress, the font of all wisdom in legislative terms, where they mandated that the FBI put together a squad to investigate the kind of information that the FBI apparently had missed in the weeks and months leading up to 9/11. This squad was supposed to take the information, like the fact that there were people learning how to fly jetliners who were not interested in learning how to land them, and investigate them. And I found the idea of a squad chasing after these things around the country to be just a wonderful literary device. And so I started playing with this hurricane idea that had been on the shelf for a couple of years, and I had this new idea about the squad that in my head I was calling the Boogeyman Squad, and I decided to write that, and my publisher was still completely uninterested, and I did write it, but I wrote it as a screenplay. And in the category of things you don't know about me, I wrote a spec screenplay in the spring summer of 2002 called Landfall that involved none of the series characters and instead was a collision between this FBI boogeyman squad and this hurricane idea that had been banging around in my head for a couple of years. And it actually got quite a bit of attention in Hollywood in the latter part of 2002. And ultimately, in Hollywood's wisdom, and my experience with Hollywood is that you will not find too many sentences that have the word Hollywood and wisdom both in them. It was too soon after 9/11 for a terrorism movie, so although everybody told me they loved the screenplay, it got shelved and nothing happened with it. We're now going to jump forward two more years, and Jeff Deaver and I the novelist, the thriller writer Jeff Deaver, and I are talking about putting together a dramatic television series and pitching it to the networks. And Jeff and I meet in Washington, D.C. for about 3 days, and we just come up with an idea for this, what I thought was wonderful television series. And a couple of things from my earlier work stuck around. One of them was a main character from the Landfall script, and the other part that I couldn't get rid of was the Boogeyman Squad. I really liked that literary device. And Jeff and I put together this script, and we pitched it, and nobody was at all interested, and once again this idea went on the shelf for quite a bit longer, actually. It's 2004, and my son is at the time in his high school life that it's time for what I came to call the college admission roadshow. And we as a family are, you know, flying around the country visiting college campuses so he can decide where he wants to apply for college. And this gets old fast, if any of you have done it. One of the things that surprised me about the admissions presentations that I was attending is that all these schools had various forms of freshman orientation that involved wilderness experiences for their freshmen. They would take a group of freshmen and pack them off into the wilderness, and somehow this would help them to bond with the place they had just left. I didn't really get it, but I did find it fascinating, and the thriller writer in me immediately began wondering whether there was a book in the possibility of a group of these college freshmen disappearing in the wilderness. And I began playing with it. So I've got this idea of, you know, I'm thinking Colorado College, School of Mines, a group of freshmen off in the, you know, Rockies wilderness someplace, and the kids disappear. Alan Gregory gets involved somehow. Anyway, that's what I'm thinking. I couldn't make it work. I puzzled this out for a year. Actually, I was working on this book when I was writing Kill Me. I just couldn't make the logistics of the story work. And I once again set it on a shelf. My son ultimately chose a college and jumped forward almost 3 more years, and I'm walking through the campus at Yale, something I've done half a dozen or more times since he started school. And I walk past a building I've seen a dozen times since he was admitted, and that's the Tomb of Skull and Bones. For those of you who are not Yale conversant, a tomb is a meeting location of a secret society on Yale and a few other campuses in the Ivy League. And the most infamous or famous of these, the one that you see gaudily misrepresented in movies constantly, is Skull and Bones. And I was walking past the Tomb of Skull and Bones, which is a particularly uninviting structure. And I'd never seen any form of life. Even insects seemed to ignore the place. And I was walking past it, and I thought, my God, the place is a fort. And this is how it actually happens for me. Before I had taken another step, the wilderness experience, kids disappearing book was back off the shelf. And by the time I was at the end of the block, I had totally reworked it. And instead of the kids disappearing in the wilderness, they were going to disappear in place. And the place was going to be Yale. And all I needed to decide was the tomb. And I really didn't want a well-known tomb. So I walked the campus and revisited the ones I had seen and ultimately chose the tomb called Book and Snake. And that's the one that you see in the front matter between the title page and the half title page. And it's the most crucial part of the story that became the siege. Without the building, the nature of the building, the nature of the organization, I wouldn't have this story. The book was a long time in coming together. I have written a book, the program, in less than 5 months. This one took almost 15. It's a tremendously complicated story from a structural and architectural point of view. There are as many changes in time, if not more, as there were in Kilmy. There are changes in voice, in point of view, in locale. It jumps all over the place. And when I originally described the structure to my editor in New York, he said, "Are you asking too much of your readers?" And what I said to him was, it hasn't happened yet. And, you know, the book is obviously done, and I'd like to think I am asking a lot of my readers, but so far, you know, people told me that readers would not be able to follow the chronology in Kilmy, and I heard no complaints, and I don't expect I will hear any from this one either. I'm really reluctant to talk much about the plot, because the plot is very small. I don't want to give many of the points away. Obviously, it involves hostages, and it involves terrorism, which was very, very much on my mind. And the theme in my head as I was writing this story was basically, what if the next terrorists aren't content to fly an airplane into a building? And what if they're not content to, you know, do something like Mumbai and shoot as many people as they can before they're killed? What if the next terrorists are good at thinking up ways to hurt us, as Apple is at Cool or Amazon is at selling books? What if we're dealing with that kind of adversary? And it gave me a tremendous amount of leeway in being able to think about a potential terrorist who has that kind of imagination. And I didn't want to make it completely unrealistic. I did not give someone an unlimited budget or superhuman skills, but I did give them this very, very secure building on the Yale campus. And I think you're going to find this story very interesting. The only series character who's in this book in any significant amount is Sam Purdy. It's his book. I originally thought it up as a story for Alan Gregory, who was going to have a patient's son or daughter as a hostage in the tomb. And I recognized immediately that I was going to be tying one hand behind my back if I tried to do that, because my narrator was going to be two steps removed from the action. And my editor actually said to me, "Do you have any stories that feature Sam Purdy?" And I thought, I think I might. And that same day, I began thinking about an engagement scene that is the first interaction that Sam has in the story. And I'm going to read a little bit of that, and this time I'm going to read it out loud from the beginning. This is in Sam's voice, and he is in Florida attending an engagement celebration for his girlfriend's daughter, and the celebration is being run by the daughter's fiance's family, who are exceedingly wealthy. "My first full day in Florida started out at the driving range. I was stumped trying to come up with a decent hockey analogy, my preferred metaphorical bias regarding most things in life. For assessing my accomplishments at the day's scheduled activity, so I decided to use baseball as my model. After a couple of dozen swings with the driver, it had the biggest business end, so I figured it should be the easiest to use. I had managed to hit the ball off the practice tee exactly 7 times. I whiffed on the rest. I knew enough about golf to realize that the goal of the game was not just to hit the ball, but also to hit it up the middle in the general direction of second base, ideally with some elevation. By my personal baseball-centric accounting, I was hitting just under 300. Not too bad for a rookie. My assigned starting time at the celebratory tournament was 8:25. By 8 o'clock, I was beginning to entertain some doubts about my ability to learn the nuances of the game in the remaining 25 minutes of practice time. My hands were starting to feel a little spongy in places, which wasn't a good sign. I was no longer even confident I could go 18 without bodily injury, which felt kind of wussy to me, especially since I wasn't even expected to walk the course. I had my own cart. I certainly didn't want to leave all my game, however limited that might turn out to be, on the driving range, so I grabbed the bag I'd been given for the day. Why I needed so many clubs wasn't clear to me yet, and joined some of my fellow golfers over at the practice putting green. There, I was more in my element. I'd played miniature golf multiple times. Putting actually seemed a little easier without all the moving parts and speed bumps and windmills and tunnels and things. So it became clear to me that the fact that nothing was precisely flat was going to take some adjustment on my part. I felt more presentable than I had during the previous evening's sunset cruise. I was wearing my best khakis and a knit polo shirt that read Boulder Boulder Security over my left man boob. I considered it serendipity that my Samuel Purdy name tag covered the advertisement as though it had been designed just for that task. My sneakers were reasonably new, with unbroken laces that were more white than gray. I was styling. The bad news was that I'd been out of the shower for less than an hour, and I was already so slick from sweat and sunscreen that I felt like the equatorial gods were marinating me to be the entree at some luncheon cookout. I really want to thank you all for coming. I'd love to sign some books. Thanks.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.